So this talk is retina surgery highlights. Talking about things that are either new or about to come up in retinal surgery. My suspicion is, and show me by show of hands, how many of you work in practices that are predominantly retinal surgery? Probably only a minority. A significant number, but a minority. And so many of you will have seen some of this stuff, but perhaps not all. For the rest of you who work in general practices or other subspecialties, some of this may be a little bit new, but there's most of this stuff we can relate to and have an idea of what it means. Here's my disclosures, none of which are really pertinent to this talk. And here are the sort of the broad topics that we're going to discuss. Things like visualization. How are we seeing things? It seems like a fairly obvious solution. The clinic, what do? Well, we see things through the slit lamp or through cameras. The operating room works a little differently. Instrumentation, people are always changing, modifying, inventing new equipments, innovative techniques, technologies, and drug delivery. Everybody knows that the single greatest advance in ophthalmology in the last 15 years was anti-VEGF therapy, right? Treatment of macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy. I love implants, I love new cataract lenses, but the treatment of those two diseases, in my opinion, is the single greatest improvement in eye care. So let's start off with this. This is the way we've been doing surgeries, cataract surgeries, retina surgeries, glaucoma surgeries for 50 to 60 years. Surgeon sits at the microscope, looks, prisms in the microscope, magnification, light, coaxial lighting, we're looking down, and maybe if it's sophisticated, there's a camera set up so there's a monitor in the room that people can watch. Does it have to be this way? Are there changes? Many of you may not have seen this, but everybody's heard of this, right? Robotic surgery. What is robotic surgery? So have anybody actually seen it done or seen the robots? So the robots are a little weird because the robot is actually a device that has four different arms to it. Each of the arms behaves like a surgical arm. And here's an example of what it is now doing robotic surgery, three arms through a single incision in the abdomen. Most of the time they do, each arm comes into a separate incision, but you can actually put them into one incision. And so you can have three hands in the abdomen at once through one incision. So in terms of invasiveness and recovery, this is a dramatic improvement from the big incisions that people used to get years ago when it was simply manual surgery and you had to open up the abdomen. The other thing is, where's the surgeon? The surgeon's at the other side of the room. The surgeon is sitting here, the patient's there, and there's the robot coming into the eye. And you've got a nurse over there who's helping and making sure things are working okay and everything is going along. But the surgeon's at the other side of the room. There's no reason why the surgeon couldn't be at the other side of the world, is there? With internet and very quick response time, that can literally happen. The advantage to the robot is multiple arms from different directions, three or four at once, not just two, come in from any direction possible, and you don't have to worry about how can I work my fingers this way or not, because the robot can rotate very well. And you can have magnification, or so that if the surgeon moves his hand 6 inches, the robot may only move 1 inch. Think of the precision that's involved with that. No tremor. So the robotic surgery has really taken off in gastrointestinal or abdominal genital urinary surgery. Thoracic surgeons, orthopedic surgeons are all using it. Can you use it in eye surgery? The answer is sort of maybe. There have been some trials where people have done corneal lacerations with this. It hasn't progressed to the point of cataract surgery, intraocular surgery, retina surgery. But you can do incisions with this, and it actually works fairly well. Hard to know if it's a great advantage over sitting at the microscope and doing it. One of the things you have to do in order to make you have to make sure the patient doesn't move. So do general anesthesia for abdominal surgery, that's easy. But here you've got to actually put the patient in a head ring and make sure it moves. So we have problems with our surgery that may not be adaptable to robotic surgery. But that doesn't mean that our visualization can't progress. So here is a fighter pilot, and these guys wear these headsets where they're getting 3D display from a computer on the inside of their visor. And so anywhere they look, they can see instrumentation, and they can see various things all projected on the inside of their visor. So this is a company in Israel, and it's a company called Bionics. And what they're doing is they're now creating this for eye surgery. And they've got a booth on the floor of the convention center. If any of you have access, go and take a look at it. It's called Bionics. And here's an example of two surgeons using this. So here's the microscope coming down. The surgeon is here. He's got a visor on, as does his assistant. Neither of them is looking into a microscope, but they're looking into visors, and they're seeing projected what the microscope sees. So they're not looking into the microscope at all. The microscope is simply a camera and a focusing device. And of course, the other thing that allows is you can project this to the room, so everybody can see exactly the same thing the surgeon sees. So this is a approach where surgeons literally can move their head anywhere they want. They can move around the bed. They don't have to worry about where the microscope is because they're not really looking through the microscope. But that's sort of newer technology. Existing technology is this, called the Ingenuity. Anybody have this or seen this? So the Ingenuity is currently available on Alcon scopes. And the way the Ingenuity works is, here's the microscope. Instead of having headpieces up here, it's a camera. So the surgeon is, again, not looking into the microscope at all. And the camera then takes the signal and transmits it to a monitor at the foot of the bed. So the surgeon's doing this, and he's looking at the monitor at the foot of the bed. But these monitors are enormous, and the magnification is very impressive because you've got this enormous view. It's a little disorienting not looking into a microscope and seeing what your hands are doing directly, but looking like this while the surgery's done this way. But it allows very, very good teaching. It allows for people in the room to see with great magnification what's going on. And this is now going to be expanded. The Alcon scopes are probably one of the more common ones used in ophthalmology. The other ones are the Zeiss scopes. And Zeiss is going to come up with a version of this themselves, sort of an Ingenuity version for the Zeiss microscopes. And so this is the way things are going. It's commonly used. It's, well, somewhat used in retina surgery. It's now being adapted to anterior segment surgery. So look for this more and more as an indirect viewing with great magnification and probably sharper viewing than what we get by looking through the microscope. And here's how it looks in the room, where you have the surgeons here who aren't actually looking into the scope, but you can see the surgeon here is looking at the monitor as he's doing his manipulations inside the eye. Scleral buckling has been around for a long time, almost a century. Basically, you have a retinal detachment. And here's the detachment. You can see very bullous here, nasal to the disc, some fluid throughout here. Can anybody see retinal breaks in here? If you can, you got really good eyes. They're right there. So two retinal tears causing a retinal detachment. And the way the surgery is done for scleral buckle is you put a buckle on the outside of the eye right over where the breaks are, so it pushes the RPE in against the retina, and that supports the breaks and fixes the detachment. And the way it's done is pretty much the way it's been done for a century. You expose the surface of the eye. You have an indirect ophthalmoscope looking at where the breaks are, and then you put the buckle, either a band around the eye or just a segment right over where the breaks are, but you're visualizing everything through the indirect ophthalmoscope. That's been the way it's been done for decades. Very recently, and here's the way it looks postoperatively from the inside, you can see the push from the breaks, from the buckle. The breaks are actually flat on the buckle, and the fluid is completely gone. So a nice success on day one. However, now that we have very small instruments for vitrectomy surgery, we have these lighting systems called chandeliers. You literally put a fiber optic that's stuck onto the surface of the sclera and shining into the eye, a very broad beam in the back of the eye. And so you put one of these into the eye, bring the microscope in, and the visualization by the surgeon is through the microscope. So now the surgeon is looking into the eye, and he's getting visualizations of retina by a single light from a chandelier lighting system. He can then depress, he can see the breaks, do his treatment with cryo or laser, and even drain fluid by sticking a needle through and watching the needle go through the back of the eye. So this is an interesting approach where the microscope is used for visualization and the indirect ophthalmoscope is now becoming somewhat passe. More and more people are beginning to do this because of the direct visualization. The trouble is, it depends on the microscope. In the US, we don't really have the microscope that gives us slit beams. In Europe and Asia, they do, and those are far superior to what we have. And that's FDA regulated. So we're not doing it so much in the US, but they're doing it much, much more in other parts of the world. Chandelier-assisted scleral buckling. Vitrectomy surgery instruments have changed over the decades. 1970, at the University of Miami, was the very first vitrectomy surgery, infusion and cutting all in one instrument. It was almost 3 millimeters across, which was horrible. It's enormous, considering what we have now. Standard since then has been 20 gauge, which is about almost 1 millimeter across, a millimeter in diameter. 20 gauge is pretty much the size of the needle used if you have your blood drawn. That's a 20. That's either an 18 or 20, usually a 20. And that's what they draw. That's the size of our instrumentation. But since then, we've gone to 23, 25, and 27 gauge. 27 is actually quite new, and there's not that much experience in 27 gauge yet. So you can see from a 20 to 23 to 25 to 27, hard to appreciate it here, but look at the diameter of the shafts that go into the eye. So you've gone from 0.91 down to 0.41, so you know a little over 40% the diameter, but when you look at the area of the cross-section, that's less than 1/4 the total cross-sectional area compared to this. The advantage is you put these smaller instruments into the eye, don't make incisions with a needle, you don't need to put sutures in afterwards, pull the needles back out of the eye, and the surgery's done. No sutures, very little hemorrhage, much cleaner surgery, actually much quicker, because closing up the sclerotomy at the end of the surgery is often the worst part of the surgery. So the 23 and 25 gauge resulted in originally low rates of endophthalmitis. People have started suturing to get rid of that, and hypotony because there was some leaking afterwards. The 27 is so small, it's almost completely self-sealing. In fact, when we do injections in the clinic for our anti-VEGF drugs, what size needles do we use? 30, yeah, I use 30s. Anybody use 27s? 27s aren't bad. 32s. How about 33? Yeah, we got 33s in the office. They work well. And patients almost don't know what's happening to them. But 27 is actually the size of a very small hypodermic needle. You can even do intravitreal injections with 27 gauge. And these instruments are exactly the same thing. So these are can be used to peel membrane, segmentation, membrane removal, and you can use it as a single instrument to treat really bad diabetic eyes. And here are the trocars that are used. The trocar basically into the eye, the little cannula stays in the eye, and you put the instruments through the through those. And here's how the instruments differ. Not only are the smaller gauge narrower across, in this case 0.47 internally compared to 0.66, but look at where the tip is. The tip is far closer to the end than it is with a larger instrument. The advantage is you get much closer to the retina here and still not chew the retina. And so you can get right up to where membranes are that are coming across the surface of the retina, where the tip of the instrument's on the retina, and you can engage the membranes that are elevated slightly and put them right into here. So smaller gauge, openings closer to the tip, faster cutting speeds. These are really good for diabetic eyes. You don't even need scissors. Well, this is actually the scissor of choice now for dealing with a lot of bad diabetic eyes. Macular holes were essentially untreatable until 1991, where surgeons in Sacramento came up with the first description of macular hole surgery, very controversial for a few years, and then it's taken off. And now it's one of the more common surgeries that we do, and it's because it's very successful. And for the average macular hole patient, greater than 90% chance we're going to fix the hole. Of those that are fixed, greater than 90% chance you're going to get better vision. The average, they get back to about 20/40. So these are really successful surgeries. And the steps of the surgery are vitrectomy, take the vitreous out to make room for the air bubble, removal of the posterior hyoid because the hyoid's pulling on the retina, that's what's causing the hole in the first place. Removal of the internal limiting membrane, the inner membrane of the retina. We usually remove that in order to prevent hole reopening after surgery. Placement of a gas bubble with an air fluid exchange, bubble may be air or SF6 or C3F8, depending on how long we want the gas to last. And then face-down positioning. Some people do non-face-down positioning. The majority of people will do face-down positioning for 5 to 7 days so the bubble pushes against the hole and closes it. And so the procedure is fairly typical. But what if we have a large hole? If we have a large hole, they're harder to close. Or what if the ILM has already been removed? Then you can't remove it, but you've already failed once because the ILM has been removed and it hasn't closed. So there are alternative techniques when these problems are present. One is called an ILM flap. You can also transplant the ILM by taking it from somewhere else and putting it in the macula. And the third thing is a retinal transplantation. Right? So patients ask, can I transplant the retina? The answer is always no. This is the one exception so far. And I'll show you what this means. So first of all, removal of the ILM during surgery. It's transparent, it's very thin, it's very hard to see, so we usually stain it. In Europe, they use brilliant blue. We don't have that because it's available, it's approved for their use, and it stains just about everything, which is actually quite good. We don't have that available in the U.S., so we use ICG or Instein and Green. Those are the work and retina practices do Instein and Green angiograms, same stuff. So green on the surface, and then you grab it with forceps and peel off the internal limiting membrane in a circular fashion, very much like doing, for those of you who do cataract surgery, very much like doing a capsular excis. You literally take off the capsule, or in this case the ILM, and it's stained green, leaving the unstained retina untouched and the macular hole now without any pulling or traction by either the posterior hyoid or the internal limiting membrane. For large holes that you think just may not work very well, it may not be good just to take the ILM off, but why not just sort of take it all the way off except for where it's right at the edge of the fovea? In this case, the ILM was peeled off to here. Imagine this 360 degrees, peeled off to the edge of the fovea, and then stuffed into the hole, like that. And it can close large holes, and some surgeons from Poland came up with this idea called an ILM flap from large macular holes, and it works fairly well. We think that it creates a scaffold for the retina to come across and then ultimately close. The ILM is resorbed, it's gone, because this is true retinal tissue here, and there's no ILM remaining, but the ILM is a temporary scaffold for the retina to come across. So it works fairly well, especially for large holes. But what about very large holes? Look at the size of this. You want to tell me what the diameter of that hole is, more or less, in millimeters? I'd say about 2. And the reason I say 2 is about the diameter of the optic nerve. So it's about the size of the optic nerve, isn't it? And here it is in OCT, and when you look at it in cross-section, it's just, it's a deep hole is what it is. You can't even see the bottom of it. So what do you do with this? Especially if this has already had macular hole surgery, the ILM is gone, so you can't do an ILM flap or anything like that. Well, what about a retina transplant? What if you took, here's the optic disc, here's the macula. What if you did some cautery up here, cut away the retina, a circular area retina about the size of the optic nerve, picked it up, and stuffed it in the hole? And that's a retinal transplant. And so you start with this, you stuff it in the hole, get this, and over time, it tends to normalize. It actually contours to the inner surface of the retina fairly well. And people have done this and report fairly high success rates of macular hole closure. The real question is, do the vision get better? And the answer is not very much. Because what you're doing is you're transplanting dead photoreceptors. Once you take the photoreceptors out, the blood flow doesn't reorganize. You don't get neural connections. And so it's hard to know, does it really work well? But we think that by closing the ends of this, see how this is pulled up? There's fluid here. And look at there, this area of retina corresponds to that is much better. By making this much better, you actually improve the vision and you expand the visual field, not necessarily by getting functional retina in the hole, because that retina here is not going to function. It's the adjacent retina that actually works better. So retinal transplantation for large macular holes does work. Here's another one where you've got the whole typical fluid at the edge, elevated retina, and here's how it looks early on with the retinal transplant stuffed in the hole. And eventually that will smooth out over time, organize, and look sort of normal, although you've lost the photoreceptors. Let's move on to visualization or vision, the intraocular telescope. How many of you have ever seen this used? Yeah, this is unusual. So this is for patients with bad bilateral macular degeneration, about 2200 or worse. Phakic or pseudophakic, it used to be phakic because they had to undergo cataract surgery. Now they can't be pseudophakic. And the telescope is implanted in one eye. And it magnifies images by 2.2-fold. So you put a telescope inside the eye, and it gives you more than a 2x magnification for that eye only. And here's what it looks like. Here's what it looks like from the top. In many ways, it looks like a standard intraocular lens. Here's what it looks like from the side. Look how thick this is. Because why does it work? Because it's two lenses separated by distance. That's the way most telescopes work, is lenses separated by distance. And the only way you can do that is to have it be very thick. So it's put in the eye like standard cataract surgery, where you do phaco, take the lens out, but then a huge incision, and this gets slipped into the eye and sits in the bag and partially up into the anterior chamber. Magnifies things by 2.2 times. The other eye can't be normal, because if it's normal, you wouldn't do this, but it has to be fairly unobstructed. The other eye gives you peripheral vision. This eye gives you central vision. So what you're doing is saying, this eye is a central vision eye, the other eye is a peripheral vision eye. And patients have, their brains have to be pliable enough to use this. And most of the time, they do okay. So this works in patients with advanced bilateral, fairly equivalent macular degeneration. Through a dilated pupil, this is how it looks. High magnification with slit lamp. So a rather unusual procedure, does work. Retinitis pigmentosa, I think most people have heard of this. It's an inherited retinal disease. Bone spicules in the retina, loss of peripheral vision, and eventually loss of central vision. So in advanced cases, patients go completely blind. They start with these peripheral scotomas. Eventually, everything comes centrally. No treatment for this. We give high doses of vitamin A. It doesn't really do much. So there's no available treatment until this. This is called the Argus II. This is as close to artificial vision as we've truly come up with. And the way this works is you put this array of electrodes on the macula, and there's a wire that comes out through the sclera and then to a sort of reservoir under the conjunctiva that transmits a signal or receives a signal from the glasses. The glasses have a camera in them, so the camera picks up the signal, transmits to this, signal goes to the retina, and these electrodes fire. And they stimulate the inner retina, and then the signal goes off through the optic nerve to the brain. And this is how it looks in high magnification. Each of these is basically an electrode. Each of these fires a electrical impulse onto the surface of the retina. So it doesn't sense anything. The sensation is the camera. This is stimulated in the retina. And it's implanted during surgery, where you have this, it's at the end of this long plastic tube with wires in it, onto the retina. This lives in the subconjunctival space and receives signals from the camera. This is called the Argus II. It's now approved and it's been used the last couple of years in patients with very advanced retinitis pigmentosa. Somebody has 20/40 central vision, they don't get this. If they have light perception central vision, then they get this because the photoreceptors don't work. So you're bypassing the photoreceptors. You're stimulating the inner retina from the inside. The cost of this, not cheap. Yep, so this is not done at your at most, you know, community hospitals. This is done only in fairly sophisticated centers that actually specialize in this. Gene therapy is all the rage now. We talk about gene therapy, and gene therapy exists in ophthalmology for a disease called RPE65 deficiency, one of which looks like, it's a fairly broad phenotypes, lots of different appearances, but one of them looks like retinitis pigmentosa, pigmentation, RPE atrophy, and what you do is you deliver the drug called Luxterna through adenovirus, put it into the eye, and you put it under the retina. The adenovirus goes into the RPE cells and then inserts the DNA into the RPE cells that are deficient in this. They start to put out the drug, and you can get stabilization and slight reversal of disease. So RPE65 treatment with a drug called Luxturna. So this is our first successful gene therapy in ophthalmology. It's only a small subgroup of patients. Not that many have this, and they have to specifically have that mutation. Can't just be any type of retinitis pigmentosa. It has to be the RPE65 mutation, because that's what the DNA is. Anybody want to guess what this costs? Yeah, right. The same as a really smart, conservative choice. So this is, per eye, $425,000. Yeah, these are not cheap therapies. What about macular degeneration? Can you do the same for macular degeneration? You could, but then what are you going to put in there? Well, currently what people are looking at is they're looking at putting drugs like our anti-VEGF drugs, soluble VEGF receptors, into the eye so that you insert them into the photoreceptors in the RPE, and it produces all this VEGF, so you don't have to keep injecting all the time. And you can do that either by injecting the drug into the vitreous, probably not the best way to do it, or put it right under the macula, which is the better way to do it, because that's, you put the drug really where the problem exists. And that's where there are three different companies now who are working very hard at trying to do this, especially given the success of Luxterna. It's not quite the same because it's not true gene therapy of it putting a gene for a missing molecule into the eye, but it's kind of creating a factory inside the eye. And so this may be our next success. So current pharmacotherapy for most people looks like this, doesn't it? We have Ozurdex, which is a pellet of dexamethasone that we put into the eye that lasts 3 to 4 months. We have Iluvien, which is a pellet of fluocinolone put in the eye, lasts 3 years. And we have the fluocinolone implant called Retisert, which is a 3-year device also implanted surgically. These are for uveitis. This one's for uveitis, bad inflammation. You can suppress it for about 3 years. The trouble is about 40% of people end up with needing glaucoma surgery because the steroid in the eye does wonders to our trabecular meshwork. But what about long-term anti-VEGF? Well, here's something called refillable drug delivery implant, and this is being developed by Genentech. So it's an implant that you put in across the pars plana, transsclerally, under the conjunctiva, and then you can stick a needle through the conjunctiva and fill it up every so often, whenever it needs. And on the inside, the implant leaks out Lucentis into the eye on a regular basis. And in a phase 1 study, they seemed to do okay, but they had 4 complications of surgery. But in a phase 2 study called the Ladder Trial, patients got up to 15 months on average without refill. Do one surgery, and they need no more injections on average for 15 months. 80% of patients went 6 months without a refill, and that's giving Lucentis. So that's not a bad way to go if you don't mind one surgery that's going to last a long time and have every so often you got to stick a needle through the conjunctiva and fill up the reservoir. So look for this in phase 3 called the refillable drug delivery system by Genentech, because this may very well get rid of a lot of our injections if this works in phase 3. One other I'm going to show you, this is called encapsulated cell technology. This is a really neat technology. This is basically putting a factory inside the eye. What you do is you put immortalized retinal pigment epithelial cells here, but you genetically modify them to produce whatever molecule you want. And they've done it with cilio-neurotrophic factor, they've done it with a VEGF receptor, they've tried dry AMD, they've tried wet AMD, and it's all failed. But they're currently trying macular telangiectasia, and the results in phase 2 look reasonably good by doing cilio-neurotrophic factor into the eye, and it's surgically implanted right there, releases the drug into the eye to try to slow down or stop progression of disease. For macular telangiectasia, it looks promising through phase 2. And we're going to go into phase 3 with that, despite the fact that they failed with these two diseases. Really neat technology, looking for success. So anyway, I think I'm up against my time. So thank you very much, and thank you for participating.